Stand by. Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We've got a great show as we kick things off with author and life coach Janice Bastani talking about equality for women in the workplace. Our social media expert Patrick Charles stops by to talk about how Google is handling rude and derogatory comments on YouTube. We then bounce to book critic Karen Long. She's got a list of must-read books, including fiction, nonfiction, and intriguing biographies. We then wrap things up chatting with Australian singer-songwriter Vance Joy and hear his song, Riptide.
Capture your need for sound.
As much as we would like to think that gender equality is improving, we as a society still have a long way to go. The workplace is just one aspect that needs improvement. Author and life coach Janice Bastani joins us to talk about women's equality in the workplace and ways you can improve your workplace environment. Janice, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Oh, thank you so much, Kelly, for having me back.
In your opinion, why aren't there more women in management positions in the workforce?
Well, this is a great time to talk about this because there is so much out there and people are really talking about this. And two things are really at play. And one of the buzzwords that probably you're not familiar with is something called a value stretch. Value stretch is a term used by sociologists when we decide that for whatever reason we are forced as men, women, and our families have to behave in ways that contradict our values. That's called a value stretch. So that means that when we as women cannot get flexible hours, or we cannot get paid enough money, or we don't have the proper childcare, we have to make decisions that are in direct conflict with our ideal of what we value most. And this causes a lot of consternation in our lives. And this causes us to be very dissatisfied, and we feel that there's a lot of inequality between men and women in the workplace. That's probably not what we're looking at, you know what I'm saying,
mm-hmm.
in the workplace where we view, okay, I'm not getting paid enough. It's not really about that. It's about what we view as important, and that's that work-life balance.
What are some of the ways women often sell themselves short in the workplace?
One of the things that women do is they do not understand what the perspective is in the workplace in general. And by that, I mean this. They get caught up in the politics that's going on. They get caught up in the compensation. They get caught up in attitudinal issues, in the woman-to-woman issues. Women don't really like to work for other women, and that's a hard thing to do every single day. And betrayal comes up. Sometimes when you're working with another woman, the whole thing is, if I'm going to be in a position of authority or climbing the corporate ladder, I have to give up something, is an attitude. Men are sometimes perceived as better leaders than women, and that's not necessarily true. 57% of the women in 2013 are in the workforce, and they're mostly Gen X and Gen Y. That means they're between the ages of 19 and 48. And 80% of those said that flexibility in their work schedule is the most important or extremely important in the workplace.
Wow, I could see that. I could see that that's important. And I think this is a common problem for probably men and women, but I think more so probably for women. You know, how can they prove to their colleagues and their bosses that they are, I don't know if the word is ambitious enough to move up that corporate ladder, but, you know, that they're ready to do it or that, you know, because I think some people, especially if they've got a family, they're like, oh, well, she has kids. It's, you know, I don't know if we can move her up because she's not going to give her focus entirely to us.
Okay, so you know, that's a different thing. See, what you're talking about there is mindset. That's a mindset issue. And mindset and perspective come into play here. So if you want to retain the best and the brightest with the most talent from the perspective of an employer, you've got to create the work environment where women thrive. See, that's one side of the equation. The other side is from the woman's side, and that comes from work-life balance, which creates a flexible schedule for her, keeping positive relationships. That means keeping the relationship positive between yourself and the other people that you work with and your employer, and the stability of the job, knowing that it's there. Look what's happening right now in our society with everything that's politically falling on top of us. Remember what I said about value stretch earlier. People's jobs are being cut down because of the health care that's coming into play now. Now we're being forced into part-time work almost for people that don't have health care, for instance. And now we're having to make new decisions. So what happens here is that if you are going to get ahead, you've got to make some very key decisions. And I've decided that there are four of them in preparation for this. You've got to decide what it is you really want, number one. Number two, you've got to decide if you don't have what's required to move up and beyond where you are currently to make more money or to be in a different position, you've got to evaluate the skills and knowledge that you may need to acquire. That means you may need to go out and take another course or gain a new skill in order to move up. You're going to ask yourself what it is you need. That's a different question than obtaining a skill, because you've got to take a real hard look at yourself and evaluate that. And fourth, you've really got to take care of yourself. You've got to understand that you can't come home from the workplace and then take on that additional role as mom and housekeeper and cook and all of that other stuff, and just you're the last thing on the list. Sometimes you're going to have to stop and step back and take care of you first so that you have enough energy to take care of everything else.
Joining us on The Kelly Alexander Show is life coach and author Janice Bastani. For more information, make sure to check out her website, janicebastanicoaching.com. I am very anxious to ask you about this next question because I think this is very important for women. When it comes to contract negotiations, since statistically, you know, women are still paid much less, it seems, I would say, overall, than men who hold the same position in whatever industry you want to talk about, how can women in the workplace ensure that they are getting their fair compensation?
All right, so that goes to point number two. You've got to know what contract negotiations are. You've got to familiarize yourself with what a contract looks like. You've got to get some coaching around it. I mean, people negate this all the time. You can go online and find out a large amount of information about what one looks like, what you've got to practice. It's like going in and giving a speech or preparing for a job interview. You've got to practice. You've got to know the terminology. You've got to know who's been there before you. You've got to know what they've negotiated. That's where that networking thing comes in. If you're not familiar with this kind of thing, you can go to people who have been in the job before. You can talk to friends that have done it, and you've got to know the language. You've got to go in there with your, I call them like your silver bullets, for instance. You've got to go in there with all of those things that are great about you, and they've got to be true. People check out everything these days. When you're going in to negotiate, you've got to come from a position of power. That goes from your, you know, your hair down to whatever you're wearing on your feet. Everything has to exude power and confidence. And that takes preparation, absolute preparation. If you're going in there and flying by the seat of your pants, you're not going to get anything.
How can women overcome some of these stereotypes that are often associated with them in the workplace? Like, for example, like you sort of mentioned before, where women don't want to work with women. I think that's like it's almost like saying a lot of people don't like dealing with female police officers. Like, I don't think all female police officers are terrible, but it's like a general you know, idea, I think, that, oh, she's for sure going to give me a ticket.
Yeah, so this is quite interesting. There are a couple of research papers that are out there, and something interesting that I just happened to get in the mail this last week from Fortune magazine, which has it's the women's issue with the 50 most powerful people, and of course Sheryl Sandberg is on the cover. And these two articles talk about very interesting things. And I'm just going to run through a list of things, and you see if this isn't something that you've actually experienced or witnessed in the workplace. Alpha moms. Alpha moms are 32 to 54. They usually have kids under 18. They have incomes over $50,000 a year. They're very organized. They're very ambitious. They're resourceful. They're very entrepreneurial. They have support at home. That doesn't necessarily mean that they have someone working in the home for them, but they have enormous support at home. They prioritize and organize personal and everything that has to do with work. They make weekly to-do lists. They take a walk and get out of the office whenever they need a break, and they go outside the office always to eat lunch. In other words, they disconnect mentally from the stress inside the workplace. They save time by shopping online, and they resolve conflicts by staying out of personality conflicts. They learn to keep their mouth shut. If they need to take care of an issue, they go to the appropriate person, and they keep things in context and in perspective. So that's one of the articles that has come up recently in this last 6 months about women in the workplace. The Fortune magazine, Kelly, was very interesting in that the article is talking about corporate America wanting to clone Sheryl Sandberg, and how can we get women like her in our upper management, director, and above level. And what they were saying is that there are some key factors that are missing in women today. It's not that statistics say that we have enough qualified, they say we don't have enough qualified female candidates, but statistics say that today we have more women graduating from college and graduate school than men. So there's a disconnect there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what's different there? The thing is they're missing maturity, and they don't have their egos in check. That's that, you know, kind of like cat fight thing that goes on
mm-hmm.
that we talked about a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm.
She is ruthless. Sheryl has been described as ruthless in her efficiency, and she follows it up with a chaser of grace. Do you see the comparison there between alpha moms and what they're describing her as in this article in Fortune magazine?
Mm-hmm.
There's a parallel there. She's in her office by 7 a.m. Well, that's hard to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Most working moms don't have in-house help like she does, obviously, because
right.
we're not billionaires, obviously. But that's a different level of proficiency that she is aspired to. She didn't start out that way, by the way, right?
Mm-hmm.
When she tucks her kids in bed at night, she goes right back to work.
Right.
Right? So that's kind of like what we're talking about here, but that's that level of difference at the director and above level.
Okay. And I guess last question, Janice, would be, how should women feel good about themselves in their workplace? Like, is there some main points that they should keep in mind? Because I'm sure if they're in a good space or good headspace, then that helps them to advance anyways.
Oh, absolutely. And this is what I'll just leave the audience with, Kelly. And that's this. It's when you come out of bed in the morning, it's not that you're going to strap on your boxing gloves and you're getting into a ring. That's not what this is about. It's about feeling good about who you are. You're providing for your family. You should feel good that you have a job. You should feel wonderful that you're doing the best of your ability, the skill set that you have. And knowing that if there's a gap between what you have right now and where you want to be, then fill that gap to the best of your ability. Gain knowledge and go forward. And don't be afraid to go in to the to your superior, your boss, or your HR and ask for a raise. 85% of those who went in, who are the Gen X and Gen Ys, when they went in to ask for a raise, they actually got that raise because they were prepared and did it in a professional manner. So don't be afraid to do that. Go in and be prepared and ask for that because you are so worth that.
Excellent. Janice, thank you as always. You always have great knowledge and advice. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Kelly.
That's author and life coach Janice Bastani. For more information, check out her website, janicebastanicoaching.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
For years, parents have complained about the filthy comments on YouTube. Even the most innocuous clip can't help but attract some of the worst members of society rearing their ugly heads. Now Google has decided to do something about it, but not too many people are actually happy about it. To tell us all about it, our social media expert, Patrick Charles. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, how you doing?
Good, good. So what's going on with this? What are they doing?
Well, it's funny because, first of all, obviously because Google owns YouTube, so people have been complaining, like you said, for years, right? I mean, even the most innocuous videos, you look at the comments and you can't believe some of the stuff. It's almost like it's a game. People like to write the worst possible thing mm-hmm. under the most, you know, mundane video. So what they've done is they've decided that, you know, Google has their own social network, Google Plus. They've decided that for you to be able to comment now on a YouTube video, you need to have a Google Plus account and you can no longer sign in anonymously.
Oh.
Yeah.
So they're cracking down.
They're cracking down, and I think it's about time because personally, like the people who like to write, you know, horrible comments, they actually think that you're looking at them and you're being offended. But the thing for me is just I find it really sort of tiresome.
Yeah.
To see a long stream of comments because most of the comments are useless. There's some websites we like to go to, and there's a great discussion on there about something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other sites like YouTube where there's no real discussion. It's just people writing, "You suck."
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's kind of pointless anyway.
Yeah. It's always weird too, like because I've seen a few where. Because I don't really spend much time looking at comments, right? Because I think they're pointless, like you said.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
There's a couple where, as you know, I'll bring in Janet yet again. But like, there's a couple things where, like, you know, let's say it's a remix or something I hadn't heard before or something. So sometimes I'll just take a look, like, where it might have come from or whatever.
Sure.
And then, you know, someone will probably inadvertently say something like, "Oh, you know, this remix sounds like something maybe Whitney Houston would have done." And then right away,
right.
"Janet, it's not Whitney. We
exactly.
hate Whitney." And I'm like, why can't you just take the comment and move forward? But it's always like you said, like something just as innocuous as that becomes
yeah.
negative. And then it's like Janet versus Whitney camps. And like, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's a very strange thing. And it's sort of attracted people because, you know, one of the problems is, I mean, YouTube being free, I think it just sort of became the place where people would go. It's almost like it's a chat room.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right? And they just wait for a target. So that's what, you know, people have been complaining about it for ages, and Google hadn't done anything. I'm surprised it actually took this long. But yeah, so they decided that now you need to sign in with your Google Plus account.
And why don't people like this idea? Because you and I seem to be for it, I think, on some level.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of reasons. A lot of people say it's free speech, but you know, that only goes so far, though. It's free speech, but then there are people who are just writing things that are hate speech.
Right.
So, you know, what can you actually say, right? Especially if it's got nothing to do with the topic. Because, let's face it, that's the bottom line, right? If it's off topic, what's the point of it being there? So, but people are fighting for that because they would like it to be just a free-for-all where you can write whatever you want. And, of course, people want to be anonymous mm-hmm. because that, you know, frees them up to write whatever garbage they want to write. And they don't want to have to sign up for a Google Plus account.
Can you actually explain to me how you sign up for a Google Plus? Because I don't have that.
Sure you do.
I do?
Yeah,
I feel
you
like
do.
I don't.
Yeah, there's one for the show. Yeah, you absolutely do.
Oh, see, this is like, I don't even, because the thing is, I've had problems accessing the Google Plus account, like for the show page that you created for us.
Right, right.
So is it like a big process, though, to do it? Or is it just like filling out stuff?
No, it's just filling out stuff. I mean, it's like any other social network. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people, see, there are a lot of people on there, but there's not a lot of activity on it.
Oh, okay.
So there's a weird sort of a debate with Google Plus, you know, as to how quickly it's growing. So obviously, I mean, you know, Google wants to steer you towards another one of their products. So at the same time, they're doing this to get people to be more aware of Google Plus. But I mean, the bottom line still is, though, is that people don't like it because they don't want to be told what to do. They don't want to be told where they have to sign up for an account to be able to do something.
Is it affecting the actual videos?
Well, this is an interesting thing. I think it is because, I don't know if you know this, but did you know that products on sale on Amazon.com, they actually sell better if they have negative reviews?
They do?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they do. Because what happens is people want to prove things wrong.
Oh.
It's a weird part of the human psyche where people want to go, well, I bought that can opener and I think it's fantastic.
Right.
The guy who wrote it's terrible is an idiot. So people like to prove other people wrong. So actually, I think it's, I really do believe that it's going to affect videos if you can't go on there and defend. Like you said, you'll see a negative comment about somebody that you like, and maybe you want to defend it. And maybe that will make you, I don't know, maybe that will sort of spur you into action. Maybe that'll make you want to share the video more. Maybe that'll make you want to listen to the music more. Who knows? So this is a, there's a big chain reaction that could happen around this thing.
Yeah, I could see that. And again, it's interesting. Like, it's like a social science experiment with this.
It is.
Yeah, okay. And is Google really doing this because they care about what we're seeing? Or is this, you know, obviously just a business move?
Yeah, I think it's really more of a business move because they, like I said, I'm surprised they haven't done this, you know, years ago. Because the comments are just, they're pointless. You know, I don't see why they wouldn't have just, I would have just shut them down personally.
Right.
And people would say, you know, again, that's, you know, against free speech. But to me, if there's nothing constructive about it, I would have just said, okay, there's no comments on the videos anymore. Because it's pathetic.
Yeah.
And the other thing too is, like I said, I mean, most, you know, YouTube is the nation's radio station.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when kids want to listen to something, they go onto YouTube. And with the amount of parents complaining about the horrible comments on there. I mean, so many kids go on. It's crazy to think that they left it for this long.
Exactly. Yeah, because it's been like years of this now.
Yeah, it's like 7 years. YouTube is, I think.
Yeah.
7 years old.
That's,
so,
yeah, and I've
so
seen
it's amazing
like a
it's
lot.
Gone on this long.
And I'm always like, because we have a YouTube channel for the show, as you know, and we've
right.
been fairly lucky with mostly positive comments, but there's been a few here and there. And you know, no one likes to get criticism. Which is fine, but sometimes you sort of look at them and you scratch your head and you're like, really? That's what they have a problem with? Or, you know, like it's really odd.
Yeah. I mean, you can't take it very seriously because it's just that people see, oh, here's a target. Here's something I can complain about for no real reason, except for the fact that I'm unhappy about something. So, you know, it's just sort of pointless.
It's like an online way of kicking your dog. When you're upset,
it is, though.
You know?
Anonymously.
Exactly. Is this this phenomenon going to affect a video's rating?
Yeah, I really think so. I think that a lot of people are going to be sort of shying away from going on YouTube. And I think that actually what's interesting is I think it may sort of, you know, really clean up some of the people that are on there, the people who like to put those comments.
Mm-hmm.
So that may affect videos as far as, you know, their view counts. Because, you know, there's a massive rally against this, that people are actually starting a change.org petition that has nearly like 100,000 signatures to get them to change it back to the way it was.
Oh, good grief.
Yeah, because that's like an important thing in our society right now. It's like, get the YouTube comments back so I can, you know, curse at people, basically.
We're always rising up against first world problems. It's tough.
Absolutely.
Patrick, thank you so much for this. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That is our social media expert, Patrick Charles. Make sure to learn more about him on our website, kellyalexandershow.com, and follow him on Twitter at GetPatrick.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
With the autumn season in full swing, there's nothing better than curling up with a really good book. Joining us to talk about some of her favorite books and what to keep an eye out for this season is freelance book critic Karen Long. Karen is on the board of directors for the National Book Critics Circle based in New York. Karen, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So before we get into sort of what's out there right now, I did want to ask you, I guess, a few general questions. When it comes to books, what do you actually look for in a good book?
I think a book always reads us. It's such an intimate experience because we co-create whatever we're reading in our own head, unlike taking in a work of painting or watching a screen. There is such a intimacy between the writer and the reader that I'm looking for craft and beauty, but I'm also looking for that emotional experience in which I let go and forget that I'm reading.
Can I ask you, what are some of your all-time favorite books?
That question is so vexing, and I disciplined myself to prepare an answer for you.
Okay.
And I did come up with 5 fiction and 5 nonfiction titles. I do want to start by saying it is a lifetime joy to have Alice Munro win the Nobel Prize
this year
for literature. My mother was Canadian and died in midlife, and I've always loved Munro's stories, particularly because it connected me to my own mother, her voice and time. She was 2 years younger than Alice Munro is.
Okay.
And I do think people will be reading her in 200 years.
Oh, that's amazing. That's a great thought.
So with that sort of throat clearing, I'd say in the fiction realm, one undiscovered or not as well-known as she should be writer for your listeners is Edith Perlman. And she did win the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction in 2011 for this book called Binocular Vision, which is a selection of 34 short stories, basically a lifetime of her work, that shows a verisimilitude and a tour de force ability to move across continents and decades that I have a really hard time finding a comparison to. And it's also a great story because this book was the first book published by a tiny press called Lookout Books in North Carolina, and through a series of happy accidents found its way to the right critics and was elevated in 2011. So it's Edith Perlman's Binocular Vision. Another favorite, which is much better known, is Willa Cather's Death Comes for the Archbishop.
Mm-hmm.
And as I told you, the book always reads us, and I got to read this book in Arizona on a family vacation, and I've never been mellower in my own clan because Willa Cather just took me outside of the mundane and sort of into the eternal in this story about two men who are trying to reform a Catholic diocese in Santa Fe. And among other things, it's one of the most beautiful meditations on friendship between two men that I've ever read. So keeping on with fiction in another masculine vein is Cormac McCarthy's The Road. McCarthy also has high visibility and writes with this elegiac masculinity. I think his topic is the nature of masculinity in our fallen world. And The Road is a post-apocalyptic story, which is all the rage now. But McCarthy's story is so restrained, almost unbearable in the suffering in it, except for the central tenderness between the unnamed narrator, who's a father, and his son, who seems to be about 10 years old. I know a number of people who couldn't finish this book because it's so straightforward in its looking at darkness.
Mm-hmm.
But the end is such a reward, such a well-earned reward for the reader, that it too is a book I'm almost certain will stand the test of time.
Can I ask you for a second, Karen, just
sure.
about, like, you know, because I think so many people don't know about all of these wonderful books that are out there. I think it's so easy to get lost in our own busyness, and it's hard to sometimes justify the time to read a book. What would you say to an audience about how to, you know, maybe understand and pull from a book and take that time to actually read it?
Well, I compare reading a book to playing the piano. The first time you sit down, you're not going to do such a bang-up job. But if you stay at it, it's like most things that is enhanced by habit, you'll find that your skills come up, your aptitude comes up, and your enjoyment comes up. So what you might have associated with schoolwork,
mm-hmm.
that falls away as you just accustom yourself to being around beautiful language and gorgeous sentences and brilliant minds. I mean, that to me is the breathtaking aspect of reading is the proximity to a beautiful mind. And I think Hilary Mantel's trilogy on Thomas Cromwell, she's two books in with Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, is going to be the great trilogy of my lifetime. She's retelling the story of Thomas Cromwell, the first commoner to rise to the elbow of Henry VIII. Not a story I particularly care about. I'm not a Regency or bodice-ripping royal interested reader. But she defamiliarizes the story that we think we know from, say, Man for All Seasons. And it's just breathtaking, both in its historical accuracy, but it's in its reimagining of essentially the uses of power, attaining and practicing power. And Bring Up the Bodies takes place over just 5 months when Cromwell takes out Anne Boleyn. It's just blood-curdlingly fantastic.
Do you have an opinion as well? Because, you know, you were mentioning how some people associate reading a book with schoolwork. And I've been fortunate in the fact that I've always loved books. I've just sort of been that way. I guess my question is, do you sometimes question what school boards and or teachers choose as book reading material? Because, you know, for the most part, I've been very fortunate. Just if I use myself as an example in some of the books that I, you know, I was told to read or asked to read in school. But for example, and some people are going to shoot me when I say this, but I had such a difficult time getting through 1984.
Oh, that's not surprising.
Okay.
You know, Orwell is humorless. He's brilliant, but the man wouldn't recognize a joke if it crashed down on his head.
Okay. And do you think, though, like, because I think I had to read that in grade 9, if memory serves. And I think that was, there was, I think there's only been two instances in my life where I have not got through a book. Like, I'm sort of a bit of a goody two shoes, especially when it comes to schoolwork. I was always sort of that kid that did it. But I never finished 1984. And I think I was maybe 25 pages from finishing Dandelion Wine and couldn't do it either.
Uh-huh. Well, I think where the school boards and teachers kind of go off the rails is when they see literature as social work.
Right.
To teach you important things. And I think of it almost as the opposite, that the great and best and lasting literature is always subversive. And children, young adults, get subversive, embrace subversive. 1984 is subversive. You know, there's parts of it I still remember vividly when the Winston's love interest tells him that if you keep all the tiny rules, you can break the big ones.
Right.
Which is so true. But not every book is going to be every child's cup of tea. So to me, pick your gateway, whatever entry point it is, graphic novels, comics, you know, series that seem formulaic and a little bit of mindless. It's chopsticks. It's all practicing at the piano, getting you to the point where you can take the great deep dive into, say, Middlemarch.
And what do you say, because here I'm going to admit this, and I'm sort of completely fine with admitting it. I'm in love with John Grisham. I've read his books probably for the better part. Like I was not far off, I guess, from when he first released A Time to Kill. Like I think I picked it up maybe 2 years or 3 years after he released it. And I've just fallen in love with the way he writes. And I realize that he might be taken as the cotton candy of the literary world, really. But what do you say about authors like that where, you know, I mean, it's not pulling necessarily always at the heartstrings. I do find that some of the way he writes, like, you really sort of question things, especially because he does so much stuff with, you know, prisoners on death row and all that kind of stuff. What's your take on an author like a John Grisham?
Well, Grisham has a lot to recommend him. I mean, he's incredibly handsome.
This is true. This is true.
And he does have, he does good works. He's, his work in Mississippi with the Innocence Project there is to be commended. In terms of reading him, I think it's useful to think about the ways we enter a book. And most of us read for plot. And Grisham tells a page-turning story. And, you know, that, what will happen next drives a lot of our reading. Other people might read for character or to enter a new setting. And you'll find that books that win prizes are often given by critics who are reading for something different altogether, which is language.
Okay.
You know, the beautiful sentences. And it can't, of course, be just the beautiful sentence. You know, Grisham has serviceable sentences and very good plots.
Okay. And so what are some of the books out like this season that people should be paying attention to?
I would say, partly because I am such a fan of Alice Munro, that people should rush to get a copy of Alice MacDiarmid's new novel called Someone. She won the National Book Award for Charming Billy. She writes about unremarkable people in remarkable ways, again, like Alice Munro. And Someone is a story of, from childhood through old age, of a woman named Marie. And I just finished it, so I'm still a little bit high from it. And there's a set piece in it in which, as a young woman, Marie is working in a funeral home. And part of her job is to tell the funeral home director's mother, who lives at the top of the funeral house, who's recently died. And she's usually surrounded by other women and nuns and old people. And they talk about the stories of whoever has died, but in that suppressed Irish way of they have a gesture when somebody drinks too much or tells a lot of lies or commits adultery. And the moment arrives when the bishop's sister dies, with whom he's had very little to do, and he sends her a dress from Saks Fifth Avenue to be buried in. And how all these women react to that gesture is, in a scene, more fulfilling than most novels I've read. It's just incredible. It's Alice MacDiarmid's Someone.
Okay. And if someone wanted to be reading maybe something of a biographical nature, what would you suggest?
Oh, a biography. That's a great question. And I found a biography last year that I am still thinking about, and it has a peculiar name. It's called All We Know, and it's a triple biography of three women who've been lost to history by a scholar named Lisa Cohen. And what she does is she looks at their marginalized lives. They were all married to men, but they were all mostly drawn to women. So they have complicated sexual lives, and they were all very artistically gifted in realms that tend to be trivialized or marginalized: fashion, gossip, and art collecting. And it sounds like a peculiar hybrid, but Cohen is a brilliant scholar and a wonderful writer. And she asks, through these women's lives, really interesting questions about what we privilege and what we dismiss, all the while telling us about just fascinating people. It's not that long, and she did an incredibly good job with it. It's called All We Know by Lisa Cohen.
Joining us on The Kelly Alexander Show is freelance book critic Karen Long. For more information about the National Book Critics Circle, check out bookcritics.org. I wanted to ask you about this. The name of the author is escaping me right now, but I was actually driving in the car the other day, and one of my colleagues at a radio station that I work for was interviewing this author, and he has just released a book called Thank You for Your Service. Have you heard about that yet?
I've heard about it. I haven't read it. And,
okay.
You know, one of the first things... For Your Service, the Finkel book.
Yeah, that's it.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. It is a very important book. Finkel wrote The Good Soldiers
okay.
in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Washington Post reporter, and he followed embedded a battalion in Afghanistan and wrote a tour de force nonfiction book reporting on their lives without sentiment in Afghanistan. And Thank You for Your Service is the update on what's happened to a number of these men since they've come stateside.
Okay.
And it is a very important nonfiction title. I'm glad you thought of it, Kelly.
I also wanted to ask you your opinion on Tom Clancy passing away recently. Obviously, again, he's sort of a popular, you know, author to follow, I guess, and I've read several of his books. What is his contribution to the literary world, in your opinion, and is it a great loss that he is gone?
Tom Clancy is a colorful writer who had this sort of nova starburst when Ronald Reagan declared him as a man who could tell a great yarn, he kind of made the military sexy again.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an insurance salesman who was writing in his spare time. And so there's the romance of the dweeby, bespectacled, unknown writer creating this world and becoming a celebrity by doing that himself. He was very geeky in a good way of doing his homework. And so he was respected within the military, even as he, just like Grisham, knows how to write a page-turning book.
Yep.
Will he be read in 100 years? I kind of doubt it.
Okay. Okay, very good. And is there, before I let you go, is there an author or, you know, your top three that you would want to leave in our heads that we explore, especially if, you know, like someone like myself who is someone who doesn't have a lot of time to read books. And so when I do, I sort of, you know, I rush back to my John Grisham. Like, I know he just released the new one 2 days ago, I think, Sycamore Row. So, you know, that will be my next one. But what would you like to leave someone like me who should expand her horizons?
Well, we haven't talked that much about nonfiction, and there are some nonfiction books that I will be thinking about the rest of my life that might be your gateway drug. And one of them, I'm a big fan of memoir, even though it can be a really debased genre. When it's done well, there's nothing like it. And two memoir that I would thrill for you to discover, Kelly, are Live Through This by Deborah Gordney, and The Hair with Amber Eyes by Edmund de Waal. Now, these two books couldn't be more different. They're kind of chalk and cheese. Live Through This by Deborah Gordney came out a few years ago, and it's about her own daughters running away and the unraveling of her family in Portland. And, you know, we glorify lighting out for adventure, and we tend to think of that story from the adolescents or the adventurers' perspective, but in this kind of beautiful call and response way, Deborah Gordney tells it from the mother's perspective of having your heart in your mouth, worried about your kids when you've done a lot of things wrong and you don't know where they are. And as the mother of a daughter and someone who raised three teenagers, I found this book full of remarkable truth-telling and a real page-turner in its own right. The other memoir that I would recommend, Hare, H-A-R-E, with Amber Eyes, is hard to sum up, but is one of the most artistically beautiful reading experiences of my life. It's by Edmund de Waal, D-E, capital W-A-A-L, and he's a ceramics artist, a British ceramics artist, who's known around the world for his own work, who inherited from his great-uncle Iggy 264 of these tiny Japanese objects called nitsuki. They're wood and ivory carvings. And it turns out that these objects were collected and passed down through five generations of his family. And the Waal turns detective to tell how they passed through the world wars, how his family, the Euphrates, were once as rich and well-known as the Rothschilds in Europe, but all that really remained of their fortune was this collection that was hid in Vienna from the Nazis. It's just a fascinating, restrained, and beautiful contemplation of the secret life of objects as well as his family. So I would be intrigued if you took up either one of those books, Kelly, and let me know what you think.
All right. I enjoy homework, especially when it's reading books. So that's perfect. And I realize I just wanted to ask you this last question again, because, you know, a lot of my listeners do enjoy the pop culture. And I had read recently, like earlier on this week, I'm not sure if it's actually been confirmed yet, but apparently actress Angelina Jolie has a bidding war going on right now for her memoir.
I saw that. Yes,
right.
Indeed.
Yeah. And I'd heard that it's, you know, a fair chunk of change that they're willing to bandy about for her. Does it intrigue you when you have a celebrity that, you know, writes their life story? Like, do you enjoy those books? And do you think specifically with her, is it overblown? Because I heard it might be like in Canadian dollars, I think it was like 51 million they could be, you know, vying for her services.
Well, greed is a potent force in the universe, you know, and they're not offering her that because they think she's going to win a Nobel in literature.
Right.
But Jolie is a genius at self-invention. And I think that whatever she writes will be much more interesting than the average bear. And as long as it's not a picture book, I have a particular disdain from celebrities who write picture books. I think she might be in the decent to read and perhaps surprising celebrity genre. Billy Crystal's new memoir is quite beautiful, and he's an entertainer.
Okay, perfect. Karen, I cannot wait to have you back on the show again, so thank you so much for your time. I hope you will join us again.
I would enjoy that so much. Kelly, thank you for listening.
That's excellent. That is freelance book critic Karen Long. She is also on the board of directors for the National Book Critics Circle based in New York, and you can check out their website, bookcritics.org.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is Australian singer Vance Joy, who has a great song called Riptide off his album God Loves You When You're Dancing. Vance, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you for having me, Kelly. It's great to be here.
Now, first of all, I wanted to ask you about your name, Vance Joy, because it's not actually the name that you were born with. So how did you come up with it? Because it sounds like a really like punchy and fun and like a name you would relate to.
Yeah, thank you. I actually got the name out of a book I was reading a couple of years ago. It's a book called Bliss by Peter Carey. It's a beautiful story, and the name just jumped out of the page at me, and I thought that would be cool if I could have an alias or a pseudonym to make music under. That'd be a perfect thing to use, so I just decided to go with it.
Now, I know Beyonce, for example, when she's sort of on stage, she says that there's Beyonce, but then there's, you know, her sort of alter ego, Sasha Fierce, and Lady Gaga has that too, and all that kind of stuff. Do you actually feel like you're putting on a persona when you're Vance Joy, or is it still you've just sort of have this different name?
I think it's a version of me. Sometimes I feel like it's really just me, like I'm really just being myself on stage, and at times you might be really in the zone performing and you're really engaging in a song and it's like you're channeling a really strong feeling, and maybe at that point it's like, you know, you kind of feel like somebody else or something's happening to you, but I think I'm pretty much myself on stage. I think it's pretty close to the real me.
Who did you grow up listening to in Australia, and who would you say is an influence to you musically, whether it is an Australian artist or group or even someone from North America?
Yeah, absolutely. I listened in Australia. I listened, to a lot of Australian music as well as international music. A singer called Paul Kelly was an influence of mine. He's a folk singer, but also I think I love Arcade Fire. I think they're from Canada, aren't they?
Yeah, from Montreal, actually.
Yeah. So they really are. Not even trying to reference a Canadian band, but they're amazing, and I love everything done, and especially The Suburbs I thought was an amazing album. I'm not sure where if things like that influence me directly, but they're a band that's contemporary that I love. Yeah, I think I listen to a bit of everything. I like Jeff Buckley, I like Sia from Australia, who's, you know, a big international star, so all those different things I think form my influences and form that kind of well of inspiration for songwriting.
Has becoming a recording artist always been the goal for you?
I don't know if that was the goal. I always enjoyed playing music and singing, and I started to work on it, and I wrote a couple of songs, and I thought, hey, I might have a knack for this just based on, I spent a lot of time doing it, and I started getting a bit better at it, and it's always a work in progress, but I felt like I had an ability to do it, and once I felt like I could do it, I didn't really look back, and I kept writing songs, and I think I'd still be doing that, like, whether or not I was like, you know, living as a recording artist and being able to, I guess, you know, do this and travel around and play my songs to all these different people in different countries. I think I'd still be doing it. So the goal was probably songwriting, and then everything else is an extension of that first pursuit.
Can you talk to us about the album God Loves You When You're Dancing? Because that's like a really hefty title to carry if you think about it.
Yeah. That title, I wrote that down in my notebook where I kind of collected a bunch of ideas a couple of years ago. I looked back on the book and I saw that I'd written the title down somewhere. And at first I just liked the ring of the words together. And then after that as well, I was thinking, you know, what does this mean to me? Why do I feel like it? Why does that resonate with me? And it was because I guess the feeling I was relating to was the idea of letting go and that sense of abandon that happens if you're dancing or if you're playing music or whatever it is, you're engaged in an activity that allows you just to be free and to kind of be at one with yourself. And I think that's the kind of feeling I was trying to translate.
What is the message behind your song Riptide?
There's not really a concise message in that song. It's a really interesting patchwork of, I suppose, things that happened to me. I had a lot of a few different experiences where I put those things in there, and there's references to movies. There's Riptide is actually, I used to stay at this hotel, kind of a motel, down at a beach in Melbourne where I grew up, and we stayed at this place called Riptide Motel. And so that word was kind of somewhere in my memory. And so when I was putting it together, that word came up to me, and I took it and I kind of stuck it together, you know, with all these different images and ideas, and I got this kind of patchwork. And the song, you know, it kind of fell together over a couple of days. And yeah, so it's not necessarily, it's more of a surreal kind of experience, I suppose, than a really concise message.
Do you have a message throughout the album, though, or is it really sort of like a collection of songs that are just, you know, that you've managed to put together, or is there like a running theme, if you will?
I'm not sure if I didn't have a theme in mind when I was writing necessarily. I often have a theme for a song, maybe, but sometimes songs, they kind of almost dictate where they want to go. So I'll say something like, this feel like this, and oh yeah, I've got these words together. Well, maybe I should just let it follow its own trajectory. So I think at the end of the day, it's really the songs, and it's just I want to write just quality songs, and I guess whatever song I feel is up to standard, and I'll put them together. And if there's some kind of consistency in the theme, it'd probably be because, you know, it's just my voice, and maybe some of the kind of the traits of my songwriting are there in each song.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is Australian singer Vance Joy. You can learn more about him on his website, vancejoy.com. Vance, is there a, you know, artist or a group out there that you would, you know, love to collaborate with, that if you actually got the chance, you might even pass out, you'd be so excited to collaborate with them?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. There's so many great artists making music at the moment, and yeah, for sure. I love the Fleet Foxes. I think Father John Misty is amazing. Josh Tillman, like his solo album is amazing. I enjoyed listening to that, and I really find him to be a super charismatic guy. And I'd love to, you know, I think maybe I'd pass out. Well, not, I don't even know if I'd pass out, but I just like I like his style, and I like his whole approach is really interesting to me. I think Bon Iver, Justin Vernon's amazing. Just like the kind of emotion that he can, and the feeling that he can translate in his songs, and that way he can engage with you. So I think those artists, and I said Arcade Fire as well, I think that all those kind of acts, I feel like really have it down, and are kind of leaders for me anyway in music at the moment.
Do you enjoy communicating to your fans through social media? And if so, are you like a Facebook guy or a Twitter guy or Instagram? Do you have a favorite?
I'm not particularly savvy on the social media. I'm more of I like looking at stuff, so I'll always be looking on Facebook and like kind of scrolling through and looking what's happening. I'm not always posting things. I like Instagram as well. I'm probably more of a watcher than a participator, I think.
Do you find it encouraging, and maybe even like, let's say you're tired or you've been traveling all over the place and you see a message from one of your fans, does it sort of uplift you? Because it's almost like little hugs from people all over the place, I guess, you know, that are randomly coming into your accounts.
True. You know, that is true. I look at my messages, and I get the most lovely messages, and they're like, you know, this song you played last night. And especially if it's a song like, obviously the single out at the moment is Riptide, but when someone is listen to another song sometimes, and it's maybe I'm not expecting someone to say they like this other song, and that's almost like, yeah, like you're saying, that bit of encouragement and that little hug that you get from someone, and it's I really appreciate that stuff. I don't kind of take it for granted. It's kind of special, and it's always, I mean, since I first played my first open mic nights, I got, you know, when it's someone that comes up to you after you play, and I said, that was really beautiful, you know, and you know when it's genuine. And yeah, that is one of the special, I guess, one of the best things about making music is that people are connecting to it, and when they let you know about it, it's a special thing.
Now, before I let you go, what can we expect from you in the next 6 months to a year? Like, what is your next sort of major career objective?
My objective is I want to keep writing songs, and, you know, that's what I feel like. I feel a bit, like, useless writing songs, so I'm on the road at the moment, and I'm trying to continue to be creative and work on the live performance, and I'm going to go and do quite a bit of touring over the rest of this year and next year, and hopefully record at the end of this year and have an album, a full-length album to be touring off next year. So they're the main things, and that'll keep me busy.
Vance, thank you so much for your time. We've really enjoyed having you on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly. Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
That's Vance Joy, and again, make sure to learn all about him on his website, vancejoy.com.
Hi, Vance Joy here. It's great to be hanging out on The Kelly Alexander Show.
I was scared of dentists and the dark. I was scared of pretty girls and starting conversations. All my friends are turning green. You're the magician's assistant in their dream.
A big thank you going out to my guests this week, including Janice Bastani, Karen Long, Vance Joy, and Patrick Charles. Here is your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Norman Vincent Peale. Become a possibilitarian. No matter how dark things seem to be or actually are, raise your sights and see possibilities. Always see them, for they're always there. Thanks so much for hanging out on the show. Any comments or questions? Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. Make sure to check us out on all of our social media, which you can access on our website, KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.